Okay. Thank you, everyone who read. I appreciate that. And now I get to introduce our discussion leader. I don't need these for that. So, man, I just love this lady. I don't know what else to say about her. I was fortunate enough to have a friend marry her, so that's how I got to know her, which was really cool. She started coming to my Saturday night home group, and I just admire the way that she works this program. Everything that she shares, I'm glued to what she says, and she's very dear to my heart. So with that, I give you Betsy W.
Hey everybody, I'm Betsy. I'm a grateful recovering alcoholic.
Hey, Betsy.
Hey. Okay, now everything just flew out of my head that I was going to say. Actually, when I first got sober, I adored speaker meetings, and I still do. But at first, I could not believe that people would get up there and say the most things that I worked really hard not to, have anybody else know. I would just come and just listen and just soak it in. So I hope that what I can share with you tonight, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, I hope that it will help you as much as what was so freely given to me helped me. So here's my story. I was born 100 years ago in Atlanta. Thanks. I was born in St. Joseph's Hospital, back when it was downtown, into a family, an Irish Catholic family, so right there you know what I was up against. I was the oldest of four children, and I wanted to be an only child, because I was that important and did deserve that much attention, and I've resented it ever since. Not as much, actually, anymore, but it was a trial growing up. I remember everything in my family had to do with alcohol. We looked great. We, you know, nobody would have said that our family had any kind of problem with alcohol, but every holiday, every birth, every death, every birthday, there was alcohol there. And one of my most outstanding memories, I guess, when I think about my family patterns, was my dad walking in the back door. One arm's opening the back door, the other one's reaching for the liquor cabinet. He was always happy to be home. He was always, you know, how are you all and how are you doing and I love you, but that drink was there. So, and I thought that looked pretty interesting, like a nice way to end your day. And it was something that apparently I chose to try to live up to. I went to Catholic school, and let me just make amends or put it out there right now. No offense to anybody that had a good experience doing that. I did not. It scared me to death. I was already pretty insecure. I just was. And those nuns terrified me. Every day there was hills that were on the way. This was, I'm not gonna say what school it was, but anyway, here in Atlanta. and I had a stomachache every single day on the way to school, and my mother would say, no, you don't. Apparently, that was a theme, too, because no, you don't feel that way got said a lot in my family. The nuns, that was back when they wore the long habits, and they looked like you couldn't believe there was a body under there, and they sort of looked like scary penguins, and you would always see them, like, with rulers or with a kid by the ear. I was so ready, I guess I was just prepped already, just, you know, at birth to become one of us because I was way into all or nothing thinking. I thought deadlines meant they lined you up and shot you, seriously, so I never was late with my homework. I thought guerrilla warfare had real gorillas. And I was just scared all the time and didn't know how to say it. I found alcohol. I still really don't remember my first drink besides my first beer. I don't know how it segued from that, but I remember sneaking out when I was about 13 years old in our neighborhood and gathering under the streetlights with my cousin, and I'm not sure who else was there, but somebody had a beer. I think it was Schlitz. And I thought it was the nastiest smelling, grossest tasting, up your nose, weird kind of thing, but I was really interested in it too. It was just sort of like home. I found out as I started getting a little bit older how great alcohol was for dealing with my feelings. You know, I think I really started drinking around age 15. First time I was really kind of getting my first boyfriend. And I could not imagine going out and not drinking. Oh, I forgot to tell you, I went to Ridgeview High School, oddly enough. It's a middle school now. But I remember that at the time it was the number one drug school, either in Atlanta or in the Southeast, I'm not sure which, but we thought that was great. It was like we won something. It was just a daily occurrence. Here, take this. Okay, what am I gonna do, go fast or slow? Kids would bring stuff in from the medicine cabinets at home. We had keg parties before school. We would sneak liquor. I and some other people would sneak liquor out of our parents' liquor cabinets and meet before school in the parking lot and have great conversations about, this makes my legs feel so rubbery. And we just went to school. That was it. I remember thinking it was hilarious when a guy next to me in study hall fell out of his chair because he had smoked opium right before study hall. So that was just sort of, this was the 70s, I gotta tell you. No, it's true, not every single person was doing that, but an awful lot were. And certainly it felt like everybody did it because they were all the people I hung with. I was in the popular crowd and never felt a part of it. I was like in just enough, but really always insecure. That's where the alcohol came in so handy. I used to drink bourbon and Coke in my bedroom. This was probably ninth grade. I had a big brandy snifter, and I would, my rationale was both of my parents drank bourbon, and I thought, I can do this, and they'll never know, because they smell like it too. So I have no idea where I got the nerve, but I would just go pour bourbon out of the liquor cabinet, pour Coke on top of it, walk back up to my room, and it was a big brandy snifter, and do that all the time. Sit in my room, think, go, you know what, this just is so comfortable. I used to be so nervous all the time. And that was how I started dating. Guys liked me, and I don't mean this in a sexual way. I mean just the crowd that I hung with, they liked me because I didn't complain like their girlfriends did about drinking and using. I thought it was wonderful, and I was happy to do it with them. And I did it really well for a really long time. I could maintain. I could drink and go to school. I was on the honor roll. I was on the drill team until I decided that that wasn't cool, and so I pretended to sprain my foot. But somehow I just managed. I had this great front, and nobody knew, pretty much least of all me, how much I had to work at not being nervous. I met the guy that became my practice husband when I was about 16. We dated for 7 years and drank constantly. And it got to the point where I would drink because he embarrassed me. So if I drank enough, then I wouldn't notice it. It just never occurred to me to break up with him or to not drink or use either. So we went to the same high school together, and then we went to Georgia, to Athens together. And I had a blast. I moved in, I was a year behind, but I moved in with him and his four roommates in this house on Peter Street in Athens where all the bases of the trees were painted silver. We never did know why. It was owned by a guy named Big Jake, and I had the best time of my life, actually. I felt, for an insecure person, I felt like I had a whole bunch of brothers who would protect me no matter what I did. And so I just drank and used as much as humanly possible, and so did everybody else that I knew. And pretty much did every kind of drug that you can imagine, except for heroin. They didn't have crack back then, but there was something called angel dust. Smoked that, it smelled like Xerox when you exhaled, or at least that's what we decided it was like, and we'd be like, this is so gross, here, let me have some. I did enough cocaine, probably. I never bought it and never really liked it, but except for the fact that I could drink more and longer and feel like I was really profound and have just fatal hangovers the next day, again, it just didn't occur to me not to do it. I hated smoking pot because it made me paranoid, but anything to be a part of, and that was a part of it. And I have to say that, you know, for the what it was like part, this was kind of that feeling that I spent a lot of years after that trying to recapture, that safe, secure, what kind of real life is college anyway? You know, or at least your first college time through. And it was awesome. I so much wanted to be a part of it. I went skydiving with the guys, which is like a fun story to tell now, but I really can't believe I did it. And my dad was furious. I ended up marrying the practice husband, obviously, and we moved to San Francisco. I was vaguely restless, and he was getting a job potential for promotion, and I'm like, let's go. It's already obvious I'm not that wild about him because I have to stay drunk to be not embarrassed by him. He was the one with the problem. I was just, you know, being social. And what would people think, you know, if I wasn't, you know, joining in or whatever? So we moved to San Francisco and proceeded to drink even more. I worked in advertising. I forgot to tell you that. I worked in advertising, which was perfect at that time because that was sort of the beginning of the end of the three martini lunch mentality, and it was just sort of part of the norm. The art studio in one of the agencies I've worked in had this loft where they do jello shots in the afternoons. I worked in a recording studio that had beer on tap 24/7, and I thought, this is so great. I did that here in Atlanta and also did it in San Francisco. What could have been, I think, a really wonderful experience living out there. And it had its moments of beauty and fun and newness, but, you know, I just was less and less happy as time went on. Our marriage was crashing and burning. And I was beginning to have a glimmer of understanding that I might have a problem. Just a little one, but his was worse, so it was so easy to just kind of put it off on him. One day in November, while we were living in San Francisco, I got a phone call that my dad had died. He was 53 years old, and he just didn't wake up one morning. Not sick, not any kind of warning flag or anything, just died. Two things really stand out in my mind about that day. One was it was right before I was supposed to go to work, and my sister had called from Atlanta to tell me. Standing in the room having a profound feeling that he had just come through the room. Just on some kind of level, it felt like it. It's sort of like I knew, it was almost like he came by to check on his way out to see if I was okay. The other memory is Bloody Mary's on the plane and drinking with a fury and with a steadiness, because I had to get through this, I had to be okay. I could not be in any kind of withdrawal, and by then, I sort of knew what that was about. If that happened in Lake Tahoe on a tennis court one morning, where all of a sudden I just, and I'm not a tennis player, neither was he, but you know, we thought, well, this is another, tribute to health. Well, like, don't, here, hold my drink while I swat the tennis ball. But I was standing there and felt very bad all of a sudden, and almost like I wasn't really there, and probably a lot of people know that feeling. It's just like, it was a surreal feeling, and I was to have that feeling off and on for a really long time. It would send me running out of conference rooms and meetings. It would have me abandoning a grocery cart in the grocery store and just running. I felt like walls were closing in, and the only thing that would make it better was alcohol. So that's how I got through my dad's funeral, and we moved back to San Francisco, and it was more of the same. It finally got so bad that I decided that we ought to move back here to Atlanta. I had lost my dad, I was grieving, and you know, in that alcoholic kind of way. Marriage wasn't working, and I did not have enough support in San Francisco, and I wanted to come home, so we did. In fact, his husband kind of fell by the wayside. Actually, one day my mom said, honey, do you want to get a divorce? And I was trying everything I could, really, because I forgot to mention this and how unnecessary. I had to be perfect. I see a whole bunch of heads nodding, but yes, it was important. No matter how much other people probably, definitely knew I had a problem, in my mind, I had to be perfect. And this was not working out perfectly at all. He was crashing and burning. I had to bail, basically. And when my mom said, honey, do you want to get a divorce? It was like, it had never occurred to me. I just didn't know what I was going to do, but it was just going to be more of the same drama and sadness and fear. So I did. And that was right around the time when I would be walking through parking lots, leaving work at lunch, because I was really going into withdrawal, because the 5 drinks that I had to have to go to work were wearing off. Literally, I would get up at 5 o'clock in the morning to start drinking to be able to maintain enough to go to work. And I would stand there and cry, and I would stand there and throw up in the sink. But if I didn't get enough in me, I could not go to work. And I would feel that feeling kind of coming in, and by then I totally knew what it was. And I would have to leave at lunch and go either get alcohol that I had left in my car, or God forbid, go buy some as I'm going into withdrawal, to be able to drink enough to go back to work. I started typing notes on Post-it notes because my hand shook so much. And I had to be perfect, so here's everything like all lined up in a typed Post-it note. Isn't it just like that? I so had them fooled. So anyway, I really knew that if I was ever going to get sober, this was going to have to be my moment to really try to escape under the radar, because, practice husband was the big alcoholic. And I started running, and it was really helping me a lot. I didn't know about AA. It was not in my realm of any kind of possibility to A, admit that I was an alcoholic, B, even consider AA. I don't even think I ever thought of it at the time. I just knew that if I didn't get it together, it was going to be disastrous. So I started running, and I tried to be as healthy as I could, and it worked for a little while. And true to the tradition in our family, we never talked directly about things very much. I knew that my mother knew that I had a problem. I knew that she knew my husband had a problem. But when I was running, and things were getting a little bit better, she said to me one day, honey, I'm so proud of you. And just like the good girl that I had been brought up to be, I'm like, what do you mean? I just am liking running. We never, ever talked about it, and part of my soul wanted to talk about it. I would be so upset, and I didn't have the nerve, or I guess it had just never happened in my family that we could talk about something like that. I knew our family was weird. I knew that it was uncomfortable. I knew my dad had a problem. He would drink every single night and get very, it didn't take him much either. He was a real lightweight, and he would just get messy. So it was just not something that we could talk about. One time I did mention that, why does our family not seem happy like all the others? Why does Dad drink so much? My mom started crying and said, oh, honey, every family has stuff going on. Your doctor's 3 sons, have all kinds of problems. And your dad always came home, and he always kept a great job, and he always took such good care of us, and he never drank during the day. And so, in my head, I'm trying to figure out, how does all this work? So anyway, I tried running so that I didn't have to have a problem. Met a guy, started dating him. Oh, so I was married for 13 years, believe it or not. What a mess. Met a guy that I had also gone to high school with and thought he was interested in me. My parents had loved him. He was had been great friends with my dad. They would stand out in the yard and survey the lawn and drink together. And he showed up one day going, "Paul," that's my dad, "I brought you scotch." And my dad said, "I don't drink scotch." And he said, "Funny thing, I do." But he was cool. He drove a BMW. He was partners with his dad in this successful business. He had money. He had his own house. He was like this self-made guy with goals. I found another major alcoholic. It turned out that we had so much in common about what we liked to do, going to bars, drinking our heads off. It was a horrible relationship. He asked me to marry him. I said yes. Thank you, God, for not getting everything that you want. We just fell apart because he was too... I really think he knew how sick he was. In fact, he admitted it later that, you know, "I just couldn't do that to you," is what he said. I thought my life was over. Never think that. But he and I dated for a long time. We went out one night and came back to my apartment, and my phone rang. And it was my grandmother saying, "I can't get your mom on the phone." And I'm like, "Oh, whatever, Nana." I called. I couldn't get her on the phone either, so we said, "Let's go over there." On the way there, I had an absolute knowing that this was bad. And this was 2 years after my dad died. And we walked in the kitchen, and my mom was dead on the kitchen floor. She had not been sick. There was no warning. It was horrible. The first thing he did was go to the liquor cabinet, and I'm like, "Yep, you know, we're calling 911, we're calling her doctor." I walked back in the bedroom and found a bottle of Ativan on her bedside table, took it, and stayed in a coma for about 3 days. It was truly horrible. After that, I really didn't know what else to do. My relationship was falling apart. My job life was falling apart. I couldn't keep it together no matter what. We buried my mom. My sisters pretty much did not want anything to do with me because I was a mess. I was not reliable at all. My sister became executor of the estate even though I was supposed to be, and I'm like, "Take it." Because by then I knew that I was going to screw up every single thing that I touched. So, not long after that, I bought a gun, and I went to the cemetery where my parents were buried, because I didn't know what else to do. It was so horrible to have to say that I was an alcoholic, to say that I was completely lost. And in my mind, in that perfect, you know, deadline means they line you up and shoot you kind of thinking, it was just not acceptable, and I couldn't do it. So I bought the gun, and I sat in the cemetery, and it was raining, and I tried to pull the trigger. I looked up, and there was a funeral. They were burying somebody just right up the hill. And I thought, I cannot do this to that family. I knew what they felt. So I didn't. So I drove home, and I thought, I'll do it in my apartment. And I looked at my cats, and I couldn't do it. Not funny, they were very important. But thank God that, and yeah, there was God. I just could not imagine how upset they would be at the sound. And then I started thinking about the neighbors too. And this was the beginning of the first miracles in my life that I started to recognize. The guy that I had broken up with walked in the door, and I always kept my door locked. And I handed him the gun, and I said, "I need help." And he took me to Northside Hospital. And I stayed on the psych unit for about a week. And it didn't take them long to start figuring out that I had other problems besides depression. And they kept trying to gently get me over to the, you know, there's the psych side and there's the addiction side. And I'm like, they said, we want you to go over with this group. And I'm like, no. Like, there's something so wrong with them, but I'm fine in here with people who, one guy came from the planet work, and, you know, there were about three Jesuses, and I'm like, don't put me with the addicts and the alcoholics. Little did I know. I begged to be let out on my 35th birthday, and they let me go. And I went back home to my house by myself. Really a bad idea. And I tried to stay sober. I went to outpatient counseling at Northside Hospital and was a mess, you know, in pretty much no time at all. I ended up selling fake perfume on the street, if that tells you how crazy I was. With a herd of other really crazy people. I spent my portion of my inheritance on that, and I had no net. This was about the time of the Gulf War, and I was terrified of it. I don't know why, but for some reason that just scared me to death. And my sisters and a friend of mine and my brother did an intervention on me because I had failed to show up for, I don't know, something. and I was late for the intervention too, and they were all just sitting there. and I'm like, what? and they all said pretty much, you know, what you say, they didn't have an intervention leader, but they did the best that they could. I had a friend who was in NA at the time, and I thought she was so annoying, but she was just running the thing. And, you know, they would support me if I would get some help, but otherwise, you know, they were going to have to bail and take care of themselves because they could not. I mean, I'm the one who almost killed herself, and it never occurred to me how it might have made them feel, but they saw me sliding right back down, worse than I was before. So that's how I ended up at the North Fulton Drug and Alcohol Detox Center on Boulevard. Because I had no insurance, I had no money. I was the only white person there except for one staff member. And I'm sorry, but I think they hated me. And I was scared to death. Just terrified. I ended up walking home to Sandy Springs after 4 days. They tried to make me stay, and I just couldn't do it. I got hit in the face with a payphone receiver because, okay, so I hung up this payphone that this woman was talking on because I needed to use the phone. But I was great at being a victim, so, you know, they're trying to make me stay and everything, and I left, and I went home. And I ended up living, letting a bunch of the perfume people live in my apartment. It was just a zoo, but, out of all of this, there was this one blonde girl who was so happy. She was happy, joyous, and free, and totally uninhibited. She would tell anybody on the planet that she's an alcoholic. And I'm like, God. And I wanted what she had, and I knew nothing. I didn't know what else to do. So I started going to 8111 with her. And she was a hairdresser, so I started letting her cut my hair. And, you know, I had so many issues about, I was so ashamed that she'd be washing my hair going, so are you still on antidepressants? You know? But she saved my life. She really did because she hooked me up with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I cried every single day that I was there, and I went to 8111 every single day, at least once a day, for a year and a half. Where my condominium was right between 8111 and Northside Hospital. And I figured, you know, I've done that. If I just go this way every time, you know, I'll be okay. Otherwise, I'm gonna end up going back to Northside and maybe not making it this time. And I relapsed constantly. A lot of people in here already know that, but I could not stay sober, and I wanted it more than anything. I was about to be foreclosed on. I was about to have to file bankruptcy. I didn't make my mortgage payment for 6 months. I had no idea what was going to happen, and I still, every now and then, kept relapsing. And my thing that I am most sad about is on one of my very last relapses, my grandmother called. Oh, wait, I forgot. No, this comes first. My grandmother called. She was 86, 87, 88. We had been taking care of her because my parents weren't there anymore. She was my dad's mother, and he was an only child. And she called, and she said, "I think I'm dying." And I said, "Oh, Nana, you're going to be fine. We're all coming over tomorrow morning. Tomorrow's Easter. You're going to be just fine." And so the next day on Easter morning, we went over, and she was dead. It was yet another moment of, is this ever going to stop? I was so ashamed. So I drank some more, couriered her clothes to the funeral home, went for part of her funeral, and left. It was, I guess, the real beginning of the end. It was not long after that. She died in, well, Easter, 1991, and I had my last drink on August 8th, 1991. Somehow after that, I didn't pick back up again, and it was only because of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had a sponsor who was great. Of course, she was perfect. That's what appealed to me about her. But she also had a pretty heavy story too, and so I related, and I did anything that she said. I mean, if she had said, you know, walk down Peachtree naked, I might have. I don't think I did. But I just did it. And I called her in the middle of the night, Easter night, saying, "I cannot believe what happened to my grandmother." It was 2 a.m. We talked on the phone for probably an hour. And I just somehow knew that it was going to be okay. I kept going to meetings and started having... remember how I said I was raised Catholic? Well, when I found out about the spiritual side of the program, I really thought I was screwed because my God that I knew growing up was mean, angry, scary, and I was in trouble. There were several times in my early sobriety where I physically felt an awakening, is the best way I can describe it. One time in my bedroom and just praying. For help. It was one time in a meeting. And, you know, if you've had it, you know what I'm talking about. It's really hard to explain, but it's just somehow I knew it was going to be okay. And I started reading everything. As my head started to clear, I really somehow knew that I needed to know more about spirituality. I needed to know more about different philosophies. I needed to know what happened in life after death. I read all about near-death experiences. I read everything I could find about alcoholism and addiction and recovery. The Sandy Springs Library, if you could print out my stuff, it just would just be amazing, the stuff that I read. And people would appear in my life and say things that I, of course, needed to hear. And it would lead me to the next thing to read and the next piece of just... Somehow I began to realize that it was all really going to be okay, and that I had never been alone to begin with. It is to this day the hugest gift of my sobriety. It's where I go to get comfort. It's where I go to get my head back on straight. All I have to do is pick up one of those books, talk to one of the people that I love in sobriety, and I remember all the stuff that I know now, and it was such a horrible time and such a wonderful time now that I look back at it, because so much was happening. I went to therapy, monumental amount of therapy. I had grief, I had so many issues. I went, you know, for 5 years to individual therapy, and then I did group therapy, and more miracles happened. I got hired back into advertising. I forgot to mention I'd lost that career big time, and had so much shame, and was like, please don't ever let me run into anybody back in advertising. And so of course I did in a meeting. Not long after that, I was back in an ad agency, and I spent 5 years back in that career. That now that I look back on it, it was pivotal for me. I got a lot of my self-respect back. I began to find out that you don't drop off the planet just because you are human and have a disease and have made a large ass of yourself a whole lot of the time. And so that was an awesome 5 years. I stayed sober. I have to tell you this one thing real quick. I'd gotten back into the ad agency, and it was like the first week, and I was terrified, and I'm sitting at a stool because this guy's supposed to, sitting on a stool in front of a computer, this guy's supposed to come and help me learn the computer system. And so he walks in and he sits down and he sits on the stool next to me. He doesn't even look at me. We're both just staring straight ahead at the computer screen. And he goes, so I understand you're a friend of Bill W. And I just went, oh my God, this is just so great. Moments like that kept me going. I just wanted to find out what was going to happen next. I kept going to meetings to hear more and more about what other people had to share, and start offering up my stuff, and nobody fainted or, you know, tried to run over me in the parking lot or laughed at. Well, they laughed at me a lot, but it was just, I cried every single day for a really long time. The world was just opening up to me in a huge way, and I prayed, and I did a lot of therapy, and I did a lot of meditating. I did a lot of just work on what is my path in this life. Please show me. Those deaths in my life just made it very clear to me that there has to be a purpose. It would just not make any sense to me, and that it was just that clear. So finally, one day in therapy, I told the group that I had decided to go back to school. This from a person who was so terrified all the time. And I was terrified about going back to school, but somehow, you know, it was that conscious contact with my higher power. I just knew that it was okay to do, and that I wouldn't drop off the planet, and that I didn't have to do anything more than one day at a time. I talked to my sponsor, I talked to people in the program. And I started not doing some all or nothing thinking and saying, well, I can at least do this and just sort of see what it's like. And, you know, at least I will, you know, I was single. I didn't have kids. I had 3 cats to support, and that was it. So if not then, you know, when? And I was 40 when I went back to school. But first, I had to get my transcripts from Georgia because I was going to go to Georgia State. And I wasn't totally fearless, because when I requested them, I got this message back somehow saying, there's been a hold put on your transcripts and you have to contact the school. And I was terrified. I mean, I spent like months circling around that because I didn't know what it was, but I was just really scared about it. And I talked to this guy, laughed at me so much, who was in the program, just like, this is your problem? So I finally got up the nerve and asked what the problem was, and they said that I hadn't returned a library book. And they wanted $25 before they would send me the transcript. So I did, and they did. And then it was, you know, still drama and touch and go all the time. I won't be able to pass the GRE, I won't get accepted, I won't, you know, all this kind of stuff. And it all just really started. I loved going back to school. I took a part-time job for 6 months. My therapist hooked me up with this accountant. I was horrible at it, but he let me keep coming. I can't even count, really, but well, yeah, I can. But anyway, after 6 months, I got up the courage to quit my job and take out student loans and know that I was going to be okay. And it was awesome. I loved it. Then I started getting a little nervous again. I got a phone call from this company that had fired me because I was drunk every day on the job. And they said, we hear that you are back out of advertising, and would you come to work for us? And we'll pay half your tuition. and we will set your schedule around your school. And will you please come? And I'm like, you have got to be kidding me. Things like that happened a lot. When my grandmother died, my portion of the money from her house secured my condominium back for me, kept me out of bankruptcy. I spent a lot of time by myself and working on myself, and I was happy to do it. There was so much damage and so much healing and so much, who the hell am I anyway? You know, I had no idea. And it was very, it was got to be a really peaceful time for me, a time of a lot of growth, I think. And I'm not saying I was happy all the time either. I spent a lot of holidays by myself. It took a while to get accepted back into my family, but it started to happen, and it was just a one day at a time kind of thing. I really learned to trust. I would go to meetings and talk about things that were scaring me and find out I was not the only one ever. I worked the steps, and I did my fourth and fifth step, and felt a huge, just kind of clean slate. So anyway, I got into graduate school, and it got to the part where it was time to do my internship. First, I got an undergraduate degree in psychology, and then I went to graduate school in counseling. And you had to pick an intern site, practicum and intern site, and I'm looking around, and of course I'm scared to death about that too, because I don't like to be new at anything, and what if I suck, and all that. And ended up here at Ridgeview. And did all the tracks up here in the day hospital. I worked in psych, I worked in addiction, I worked in the relapse track and impaired professionals and the evening program. And when my internship came to an end, oh, by the way, huge, just eye-opener for me, because to me this was the scariest thing in the world. And I met staff who were so smart and so fun and so funny and so understanding. You know, and of course I immediately, like, they all have their shit together, and how they're gonna find out immediately, I don't. But they were really nice about it. And I just had a blast, and it came to the end of my internship and they asked me to stay and be a case manager. Who knew? And I said no. I said no, I can't afford to do that. You know, I need to be working 8 jobs and I can't do it, and I still need to finish. I've got like another semester left. And they talked me into it, and I said yes. So I finished being an intern on Friday and started as a case manager in the evening program the next Monday. Nothing fell apart. Money worked out fine. You know, it all unfolded the way that it was supposed to. And I really loved working in the evening program too. Some of you remember Walter Brooks. I worked with him. He made me laugh on a daily basis most of the time. I met incredible staff. And then it got to be I did that for 7 years altogether, actually. And finally was beginning to feel restless, like it was time for the next thing to do, and somehow got up enough strength and hope to quit and start doing private practice. By then I was getting a little bit better at just stepping out on faith. I had no clients, I didn't take insurance, you know, but I just did it anyway. And things were really working out. Some of you know that I met one of us here and fell in love, and another huge God thing, ended up marrying my real husband. he was worth the wait. In between all that stuff, no dating. When I told you I spent a lot of time by myself. I had no interest in meeting anybody else. I really was happy, and I wasn't just people kept saying, don't you want to get married? Don't you want to have a relationship? And I'm like, I started going like, am I weird? But I really liked what I was doing. I was growing, and anyway, so we changed everything. And we're about to get married, and a couple of months before it, we get a phone call. And my brother died. He was 46, and he just didn't wake up one morning. And we got through that, too. I have a program. I have a sponsor. I have my spirituality and my faith. I have coping skills today. People from the program showed up at the viewing. It was just, it was amazing. I know that I do not ever have to do anything alone again. I know that I don't ever have to and probably shouldn't ever make any decisions on my own. That all together we make up a pretty fabulous brain, you know, if we just lean on each other. So today I could not, literally, I could not be happier. I do a lot of different things. I still do an impaired professionals group here, so I couldn't leave Ridgeview all the way. And I love my group. They do more for me than I do for them, I think. I work in a three-quarter residence. I've got my private practice. I work at an outpatient counseling center. I still think addiction, mental illness, is the most fascinating subject to me. What I do know now that is worth every moment of this is that every time I think something horrible has happened, it was always for growth and there was always a bigger picture. I know it with just a calm certainty now that I've never had before. So when I tell people, and I do tell them as much as they will listen usually, you know, when you feel like your life has completely fallen apart, you know, like when you go to treatment, when you have tried everything else, when you really have to surrender, be respectful of that because you are being given a huge gift and all you have to do is just take advantage of it and wait and trust and take it one day at a time. The hardest thing for us most of the time is not doing something. That I learned to sit and be okay. And I learned that because of all of you. So that is my story, and I hope it was helpful. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Betsy. I whispered in her ear that I could totally identify with just about every part of that, so